Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf, the award-winning Jeff Wolf behind the console, and Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. Another action-packed Friday in the news cycles. As you may have heard by now, yet another object was spotted over U.S. skies. This time it was downed by the U.S. Air Force. And we've got all the details for you on that this morning. And obviously a very busy week on Capitol Hill, Republican hearings, the State of the Union address from the president. And we'll be talking with our experts on all these topics. We'll be chatting with KT McFarland, of course, former Deputy National Security Advisor, John Gizzi, White House correspondent at Newsmax, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer of the London Center for Policy Research, our national security expert. Jennifer Harper from the Washington Times will be with us. Cheryl Atkinson as well. Jim Trusty will have the very latest on the Alex Murdaugh hearing and what's going on. So lots to cover here on the Saturday Morning Update. And to begin things, this new object that was spotted over Alaska was downed by the U.S. Air Force, and Brigadier General Pat Ryder is the Pentagon spokesman, and instead of me trying to explain it to you, I will let Pat tell you what it's all about.
At the direction of the President of the United States, fighter aircraft assigned to U.S. Northern Command successfully took down a high-altitude airborne object off the northern coast of Alaska at 1:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time today within U.S. sovereign airspace over U.S. territorial water. On February 9, North American Aerospace Defense Command detected an object on ground radar and further investigated and identified the object using fighter aircraft. The object was flying at an altitude of 40,000 feet and posed a reasonable threat to the safety of civilian flight. U.S. Northern Command is beginning recovery operations now. We have no further details about the object at this time, including any description of its capabilities, purpose, or origin. The object was about the size of a small car, so not similar in size or shape to the high-altitude surveillance balloon that was taken down off the coast of South Carolina on February 4. Separately, U.S. Northern Command continues their recovery operations in support of the recent takedown of the Chinese high-altitude surveillance balloon. Recovery teams have mapped the debris field and are in the process of searching for and identifying debris on the ocean floor.
So this is all happening on Friday afternoon, and it was kind of interesting. John Kirby is at White House Communications now, and he was doing a briefing, getting a lot of questions about the balloon that we shot down earlier in the week. And then a reporter asked him about this new object. So it was sort of the reporters asking about it that brought the story out from John Kelly. He addressed it briefly, and then, of course, Pat Ryder had a lot more detail within the hour over at the Pentagon. And this is what John Kirby had to say about the new object when he was asked about it.
We do not know who owns it, whether it's state-owned or corporate-owned or privately owned. We just don't know. We don't know. So I said state-owned. We don't know if it's state-owned. And we don't understand the full purpose.
And that's John Kirby. There was a lot of activity on Capitol Hill this week. There was a briefing among the senators on the first spy balloon that we had a problem with. And Lisa Murkowski is, of course, the Republican sort of senator from Alaska. And here's what she had to say about how she felt about that spy balloon over her state.
As an Alaskan, I am so angry. Alaska is the first line of defense for America. It's like this administration doesn't think that Alaska is any part of the rest of the country here. To get to the United States, you've got to come through Alaska. Seems to me the clear message to China is we got free range in Alaska. They're going to let us cruise over that until it gets to more sensitive areas. Tell me where the sensitive areas are.
So that's Lisa Murkowski. Of course, Tom Cotton, the U.S. Senator from Arkansas, Republican, he takes no prisoners. Here's what he had to say.
Anytime a Chinese airship enters American airspace, it's a major breach. I can tell your viewers that what they see is exactly what happened here. China sent a balloon to spy on America. The Biden administration had a chance to shoot it down off the coast of Alaska, chose not to do so, and the balloon proceeded to spy all across America. And as you say, if some amateur photographers and civilian pilots in Montana hadn't spotted this balloon, do we really think that the Biden administration would have notified Congress, would have alerted the American people, certainly would have shot it down? Almost certainly not. It'd be on its merry way, vacationing somewhere off the coast of the Bahamas right now.
And you heard where he referenced the notion that it was a breach. Well, that's in contrast to President Biden, who was doing the rounds on the media outlets the next day after the State of the Union address. And President Biden was asked about it, but he didn't think it was a breach.
It's not a major breach. I mean, look, it's totally it's a violation of international law. It's our airspace. And once it comes in our space, we can do what we want with it.
So they had this briefing, and what I always find interesting about Capitol Hill is that all Republicans can look at everything exactly the same way, and all Democrats can look at the same thing and see it 180 degrees the opposite. Now, we've got a couple of clips here. This is Roger Marshall. Roger Marshall is a U.S. Senator from Kansas, and he came out of the briefing and here's what he had to say about it.
There's nothing in there that I learned that would have said that we shouldn't have shot it down when it was over Alaska.
So, you heard him. There's nothing I heard in there that says we shouldn't have shot it down over Alaska, which would have been at first and would have been the opposite of what the Biden administration did on that first balloon. Well, Chris Murphy, Democrat, is a senator from Connecticut, and he went to the Chris Coons School of Apologizing for everything that Biden does wrong. And Chris Murphy looked at it exactly the opposite of Roger Marshall.
Everything I learned today confirms that the administration made the right decision.
So everything the administration did was right, according to Chris Murphy. It is 6:17. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
The accident in Lanham on eastbound 50 approaching the Beltway has been cleared. All lanes have been reopened. Watch out for some residual delays there. You will still find accident activity, though, in the district. An accident still being reported westbound on the freeway. At exit 1D, that is 8th Street, all lanes still reported to be closed, so follow police direction there. Also in Fort Totten, a portion of Fort Totten Drive is closed between Gallatin Street and Rock Creek Church Road due to accident activity. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and dry for your Saturday. Temperatures much colder behind this cold front, but seasonable for this time of year. Upper 40s for highs, and tonight will fall into the mid-30s for lows. Rain chances start in the morning, rain lasting all day long, increasing in intensity by the time we get to the evening hours, and the winds picking up by tomorrow night heading into Monday morning. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
Morning update continues, and we mentioned the Republican hearings up on Capitol Hill this week. One of them involved the weaponization of the FBI. Those are the Republican claims. The Democrats, of course, see it exactly the opposite. Jim Jordan kind of laid it out, and he's heading up that committee, and here's how he set it up.
In my time in Congress, I have never seen anything like this. Dozens and dozens of whistleblowers, FBI agents coming to us, talking about what's going on, the political nature at the Justice Department. Not Jim Jordan saying this, not Republicans, not conservatives, good, brave FBI agents who are willing to come forward and give us the truth.
What was interesting, there were some former agents testifying, but also testifying in the House hearing was Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa. And he's been aware of this. He's been working on it on the Senate side. But very interesting testimony from Chuck Grassley.
Whistleblower disclosures to my office make clear that the FBI has within its possession very significant, impactful, and voluminous evidence with respect to potential criminal conduct by Hunter and James Biden. These disclosures also allege that Joe Biden was aware of Hunter Biden's business arrangements and may have been involved in some of them. It's clear to me that the Justice Department and the FBI are suffering from a political infection that, if it's not defeated, will cause the American people no longer to trust these storied institutions.
And I want to get one more in on the FBI, and this is Senator Mike Johnson. He's from Louisiana, Republican. He was talking after the hearings and kind of helps to put it in perspective here.
Well, we want the American people to see what we have been hearing for the last 2 years since President Biden took office, and under the stewardship of Director Christopher Wray at the FBI, and of course the Attorney General himself, Merrick Garland. It's apparent to us, and we want the American people to understand the facts of why the FBI has been politicized, and why there is this corruption. That's the word we use. You call it cultural rot, however you describe it. This is clearly going on, and it is diminishing our system of justice. It's a serious problem, and I think yesterday's hearing began to uncover some of these facts, and I think people are beginning to face the music here.
Well, by now, after the State of the Union, you've probably memorized President Biden's comments on the Republicans and Social Security, and keeps maintaining that the Republicans want to get rid of Social Security. He went out on the road both Wednesday and Thursday repeating the same basic lie. I mean, that's basically a lie, and it all stems from Senator Rick Scott of Florida, where he suggested that Social Security, as well as other government agencies, sunset every 5 years. And what that means is they refund everything. They fund it again, but they look into everything, check it out, make sure everything's sort of efficient, and then they will re-up the funding. And Rick Scott, this is a tweet, so if you're not hearing the clip on this, but Rick Scott responding to the president and really getting pretty upset about this, says, quote, "Does he think I also intend to get rid of the U.S. Navy or the Border Patrol or air traffic control maybe? This is the kind of fake gotcha BS that people hate about Washington. I've never advocated cutting Social Security or Medicare and never would." So that is the response from Senator Rick Scott. Now, you know, when the president made the comment, you saw the Republican hoopla on the floor there in the House of Representatives. And Marjorie Taylor Greene called him a liar. And didn't go over too well with James Carville. Now, we all remember James Carville, and he had some headline-grabbing comments about the Republicans.
Well, you know, I told people I have equivalent of a PhD in white trashology, and you saw real white trash on display. And let me say something about Congressman Marjorie Taylor Greene. She dresses like white trash. She really needs a fashion consultant. Could I recommend George Santos? He could do a good job of dressing up where she doesn't announce her white trashdom.
Well, it takes one to know one now, doesn't it? And James Carville continued.
And Kevin McCarthy, who is not white trash, he's just white jello. He knew what happened. And you cannot do anything. They have low quality people. Lauren Boebert, you know, met her husband when allegedly, according to police report, exposed himself to her at a bowling alley. This is not makeup stuff. This is who they are. And even McCarthy, as gutless and spineless as he is, knew that they walked right into the trap.
What a sport James Carville is. Anyway, one other note on this. The media, of course, it was a firestorm about the rowdy Republicans, the disrespect for the president, a bunch of crazies, all this kind of thing going down in the media the day after. None of those progressive media outlets that I heard reminded us of Speaker Nancy Pelosi during Donald Trump's final State of the Union address. After he finished, the Speaker of the House ripped up the president's speech on national and global television. Now, she's supposed to be the adult in the room, right? Keep that in mind, that Nancy Pelosi is the one who is setting the tone. And she does probably premeditated one of the most egregious things I've ever seen in a State of the Union address, ripping up the president's speech. So nobody reminded anyone of that. If you may have noticed, Kevin McCarthy, the new Speaker of the House, was trying to keep his rowdy Republicans under control, and he shushed them a couple of times, and he did not go ripping up any speeches, basically tried to keep everything under control. But never forget Nancy Pelosi ripping up the president's speech, which is probably the most disrespectful thing that I can ever recall happening in a State of the Union address. It is 6:26. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. A lot more to cover this morning. Stay with us. In the news at 6:30, a U.S. military fighter jet has shot down an unknown object flying off the northern coast of Alaska. That from the White House officials yesterday. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says the object was flying at about 40,000 feet, posing a reasonable threat to the safety of civilian air travel. Kirby says President Biden ordered the military to down the object, which the spokesman described as roughly the size of a small car, much smaller than the massive suspected Chinese spy balloon downed by Air Force fighter jets on Saturday off the coast of South Carolina. The subpoena to former Vice President Mike Pence is a milestone moment in a Justice Department special counsel investigation. It does not guarantee that he will be testifying before that grand jury anytime soon. Pence is the latest former Trump administration official to be subpoenaed as part of the investigation into efforts by Trump and his allies to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. He's the highest-ranking official known to have been summoned, and the action sets the stage for a potential clash over executive privilege that could test, or at least delay, the Justice Department's ability to get Pence to testify. And as the National Archives became aware of classified documents in President Biden's old office at a Washington think tank, archives officials were also interested in papers that had been shipped to a law office in Boston by the president's personal attorney. Emails released late yesterday under a Freedom of Information request from the Associated Press and other media entities do not go into any detail on why the archives would have sought the material sent to Boston. But a person familiar with the matter said a Biden lawyer had been packing up papers at the Penn Biden Center in Washington that could be of use for a potential future presidential library, mostly personal details about Biden's family, according to the AP story. It's 6:32. Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In the district, a couple of incidents to watch out for. You will still find accident activity westbound on the freeway at 8th Street in Southeast. That is exit 1D. Watch out for lane closures and detours through the accident scene. Also in the district, a portion of Fort Totten Drive is closed between Gallatin Street and Rock Creek Church Road due to accident activity. But the earlier accident on Eastbound 50 approaching the Beltway in Lanham has been cleared. In Laurel, the earlier works and the utility works southbound on Route 1 at Marshall Avenue has been cleared from the roadway. Everything now reopened. On the outer loop at George Avenue, watch out for construction along the right side. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and dry for your Saturday. Temperatures much colder behind this cold front, but seasonable for this time of year. Upper 40s for highs, and tonight will fall into the mid-30s for lows. Rain chances start in the morning, rain lasting all day long, increasing in intensity by the time we get to the evening hours, and the winds picking up by tomorrow night heading into Monday morning. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
38 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:34 on the Saturday Morning Update. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper is with us. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, we got two playing fields we can talk about this morning, the one on Capitol Hill or the one in Glendale, Arizona, for the big game tomorrow. Why don't we start on Capitol Hill? A number of Republicans in the State of the Union address didn't quite take it sitting down. You've got an article this week about that.
Yes, I did. The article title is called Republican Gumption Returns. Don't you love that word, gumption? Well, anyway, I think that's what's happening here. It's not like Republicans lashing out. It's gumption. Old school word, but anyway, let's get rolling with this.
I like that word.
Well, you know, a lot of people have always thought that civility among lawmakers is the best way to go, and you have to have partnerships between Republicans and Democrats and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of people are beginning to step forward and say, well, wait a minute. And I'll quote one of those folks today, and that would be Stephen Cruiser. He's a senior columnist and associate editor of PJ Media. And here's what he says. Republicans in Congress need to be far less decorous, especially until November 2024. Put more plainly, less Mitt Romney and more Marjorie Taylor Greene. How do you like that? But anyway, we all know that Marjorie Taylor Greene, she certainly was a visible presence during the big address this week in her gorgeous coat and a couple of heckles here and there. And Mr. Cruiser certainly praised her for that. And of Mr. Romney, he said that he sat idly by and admired his latest manicure. So, wow. Anyway, so the decorum and bipartnership stuff may not be so effective at the moment. He says, when you are in a street fight, you don't worry about what people are going to think afterwards. You think about doing whatever you can in the moment to survive. That's the mentality Republicans should have right now. You can still have a brick thrown at your head while hanging around above the fray. Too many in the GOP still have not digested that reality. And that's coming from Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media. And I happen to think that we need to revisit some Ronald Reagan at this time to kind of counterbalance all of that. And if you recall, our listeners recall that Ronald Reagan had something he called the 11th Commandment. This is when he was California governor. He coined this phrase in 1966, again, the 11th Commandment. He said, thou shalt not speak ill of any fellow Republican. So lots to think about in that world.
All eyes on Glendale, Arizona. The big game is tomorrow, and you have an interesting look at it.
Yeah, I do. You know, certainly I'm sure there are a lot of puns out there about political football and so forth. But if you're wondering, 193 million people are expected to watch the Super Bowl. Think about that huge audience. And I don't know. I can't even conceive of that. But anyway, we're going to go to the University of Massachusetts Lowell Center for Public Opinion this morning. They have some numbers here that are of interest to Super Bowl fans and non-fans alike. They are saying that more than half of U.S. adults, that's 52%, are concerned about player injuries. I'll just put it in a simple way that way. They call it a major problem in the NFL. Two-thirds of them, 67%, believe that long-term health problems caused by hits during the game are a major problem for the athletes. And, gosh, I don't mean to sound like a wet blanket here, but I sort of am concerned myself. But anyway, moving right along, this is according to Associate Professor John Claverius. He says Americans are profoundly concerned about almost every aspect of professional football on and off the field. Nonetheless, they cannot stop watching. He says even though they're concerned about the injuries, they're also concerned about possible domestic violence related to players or violent crimes even, they still have the love of the players. And I thought that was really kind of significant. He says this reveals something at the heart of American sports fandom. Americans are disturbed by the excesses of professional football precisely because they love the players so much. And that part reminded me of my mom and dad back in the day, how much they loved the then Redskins, and certainly these days would go just head over heels for the Commanders. But anyway, moving right along, the numbers are true about this all the way across our political realms. Let's see, Democrats, 43% of them, 37% of Republicans describe themselves as ardent fans of professional football, and liberals, conservatives, almost the same polling numbers there. And this is the poll of 1,000 adults conducted January 25 through 30.
You know, we could all use some help with our taxes, but there is one group of people that gets some help from the Defense Department.
Yes. This is another nice thing that the Defense Department has done, because we've all got that tax filing deadline looming over our heads. And they are providing a very helpful resource for our troops. And they announced just on this Thursday that they free expert support and e-filing for the 2023 tax season are now available for the military community. They are saying a DOD benefit offered through Military One Source. It's called MilTax, and it includes tax preparation e-filing software developed specifically for the military community. And all you military folks know what I'm talking about, all the traveling and so forth and so on, and relocation. And anyway, they also have personalized virtual support on this. And the MilTax consultants are especially trained to assist our service members and their immediate families how to understand the complex tax situation, such as tax forgiveness, refunds for surviving family members, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, if you know someone that needs help there, very easy to get to it. It's MilitaryOneSource.com. And, again, that's MilitaryOneSource.com. All you have to do is look under the benefits and resources headings, and might be very helpful for someone you know or yourself.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams has thrown some pretty exorbitant numbers out there about the cost of housing the incoming migrants.
Oh, my gosh. Well, this is a big deal even for the Big Apple here. This week, Mayor Adams, he decided to kind of make a command decision because of the numbers of asylum seekers who are still arriving. His idea this week was to convert a 50-story Holiday Inn Manhattan hotel, which is actually considered like a luxury hotel, and it has 492 rooms, and now he wants to house families and single women among the arriving migrants. That's according to his office this week. He said that they have had 44,000 asylum seekers arriving in the past 10 months alone, and they've provided shelter and support. You've already seen a lot of complaints about that already. But he says, we continue to meet all our moral obligations, serving those arriving with dignity and care, but we remain in serious need of additional support from our federal partners. That's when it's going to get kind of complicated. And if you're wondering, New York City has already opened 83 hotels to serve as emergency shelters. Yeah, that's a lot, along with 5 relief centers. This is according, again, to the mayor's office. He says our federal partners need to act now before we reach a breaking point. And so I got the numbers today for you. And this is actually according to a New York Post idea that they came up with. They offered a very handy overview. They did all the math and found out that the hotel will charge the city $190 a room. And they say at full capacity, that would amount to $93,500 a day, or an estimated $10.5 billion through May 1st, 2024. So that's numbers to think about. And New York can frustrate some people, but that's an awful lot to deal with.
A lot of polls out this week on how Americans feel about President Biden's handling of the country. You've got a poll from one of the top polling organizations about sort of how we all feel in general.
Yeah, this is a good one. This is a very good summation of things. Again, this is a Gallup poll, 1,011 U.S. adults, conducted January 2nd all the way through the 22nd and released February the 2nd. Here we go. 65% of U.S. adults say they are satisfied with the quality of life in America. 61% are satisfied with the opportunity to get ahead through hard work. 48% are satisfied with the influence of organized religion. 33% are satisfied with the size and power of the federal government. 33% are satisfied by the system of government and how well it works. 27% are satisfied by the size and influence of major corporations. 24% are satisfied by the way income and wealth are distributed to the in the United States. Last but not least, 20% are satisfied with the moral and ethical climate of the nation. So we started out okay with that and kind of descended down to 20%. But that's the way people are feeling today, and looks like a lot of mixed feelings out there.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway, Washington Times, as always, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Have a good weekend, everybody.
6:45, we'll talk to Jim Trusty next. But first, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Virginia, there is accident activity on 95 southbound between Lorton Road and Route 1 in Woodbridge, and the left lane is blocked. That is causing a brief delay. You will still find crash activity as well In the district, westbound on the freeway at 8th Street and Southeast, that is exit 1D. Watch out for detours there. And Fort Totten Drive is still closed in both directions between Gallatin Street and Rock Creek Church Road in Northeast, and that due to crash activity as well. In Kensington, a portion of Beach Drive is closed for recreational activities this weekend between Connecticut Avenue and Knowles Avenue. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and dry for your Saturday. Temperatures much colder behind this cold front, but seasonable for this time of year. Upper 40s for highs, and tonight will fall into the mid-30s for lows. Rain chances start in the morning, rain lasting all day long, increasing in intensity by the time we get to the evening hours, and the winds picking up by tomorrow night, heading into Monday morning. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
38 degrees in the nation's capital, 646, the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty is with us. He is a member of the Trump legal team, a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, and the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
The number of leaks that seem to be coming out in the Mar-a-Lago investigation in this case, whereas in the Biden instances, somehow the Department of Justice was able to keep the Biden document story quiet from November 2nd into January, but there are so many leaks attributed to this source or that source, and of course they don't identify the source. So it's just must be a headache for you.
I think a headache is probably an understatement. I mean, it's really maddening to see whether it's DOJ or the FBI or some combination. They continue to leak anything and everything that they think makes President Trump look bad. And this week, that even included the fact of a sealed proceeding in the D.C. District Court, as well as the result of that hearing. That's in the ABC article that's now circulating as of last night. So, you know, to me, it really brings home the problem with government leaks, which is it is a campaign of character assassination. It's self-promotion. It's hurting people that don't deserve to be hurt. They can either bring a case to court or not. But this innuendo, this leaked campaign, it's outrageous no matter who the other person is. And, of course, whether you like or don't like President Trump, he is the political opposition to the sitting administration. So, again, stepping back and just thinking historically, I can't think of any parallel to a sitting president having an administration that so freely leaks damaging information at the expense of a rival candidate. It's a different world we're living in because of this politicized DOJ and FBI. And Rick, it's not the only abusive process. You know, I was with DOJ for 17 years. I was a prosecutor for 27 years. I'm certainly used to aggressive cases. I mean, we had cases that I prosecuted that involved murder, multiple murders, gang rapes, child murders, things where you absolutely felt righteous in pursuing the case and wanted to do everything you could to develop evidence. But in this case with President Trump, they have taken to being over-aggressive at every juncture. They intimidate witnesses. They're taking almost everybody's cell phone they can get. They're telling people, you better give me the password to your company's laptop or I'm going to drag you into the D.C. grand jury in 3 days. They are literally abusing the criminal process for something that at its heart was never a crime under the Presidential Records Act. So there's a lot there, some of which I'm allowed to talk about, some of which I'm not. But, you know, my hope is that if we're not going to play this out in court, but it's just going to be a series of leaks and innuendos or maybe some sort of politicized report. Now, I hope that the House Committee on Weaponization of Federal Government looks into it. I hope that we find a way to show that this really was a historic, out-of-control trophy hunt by investigators who seem to think the ends justify the means when it comes to President Trump.
Periodically, there is a criminal case, a trial, that just kind of grips the nation. And so much attention is being paid to that Alex Murdaugh trial going on in Walterboro, South Carolina. Some quote-unquote bombshells out this week. So what struck you about the highlights of the testimony?
Yeah, I mean, the government continues to weave together a circumstantial case with lots of nice little nuggets. And one of them was, you know, this fight they had last week that spilled over into this week as to whether or not they'd be able to present all sorts of solid evidence of Alex's financial distress. And that came home pretty powerfully this week with evidence from even his best friend saying Alex had been addicted to drugs for many years, that he admitted stealing from clients and stealing from the firm. And they had a hearsay statement that was, again, heavily fought over in terms of evidence, where Maggie, the wife, apparently told someone days before her murder that she was very worried that the family did not have enough money to pay the settlement that was going to come about from the fatal boat accident where Paul was sued for slamming his boat into the girlfriend on the dock, which killed her, and what seemed to be a situation where he may have been intoxicated. So there's this looming wrongful death case that was going to cost a solid amount of money. And again, days before her passing, Maggie was fretting about that openly. So again, all those little circumstances of finances came out pretty cleanly over the last few days. There's still a little bit left. The housekeeper had some interesting testimony as well. And she came to the stand to basically say Alex wore a particular outfit on the day of the murder, which has now completely disappeared from his wardrobe. And she knows that because she does all the laundry. But when pressed as to how she could ever be so sure that this was the lime-colored shirt he wore on the day in question, she said, "I remember it well because I actually had to fix his collar for him." You know, it's those little details like that that are devastating when a witness gets questioned about something that could be, hard to believe at first, and they have some sort of detail that drives it home that they know exactly what they're talking about. So the circumstances continue to kind of gel. The government said they thought they'd be done originally by the end of this week, but they need a few more days. The defense is saying they need a week, and I have to confess to you, Rick, almost every trial I've ever seen, the defense says they're going to take longer than they do. And there's a lot of reasons for that probably, but so I'm not convinced it'll be another full week of defense testimony. I think the case probably gets to the jury about a week from Monday or Tuesday, either the 20th or the 21st.
So from what you've seen so far, do you have a sense of where this may be leaning at this point? Is it like a very strong case and you would think the jury's going to convict? Or do you think there's enough reasonable doubt floating around out there? Or is it just too early to make even that kind of a judgment?
Yes, it's all of the above. And so here's the thing, a couple of kind of competing factors here. You know, the starting point is the government is pushing hard to establish that financial distress is the reason why this man would kill his wife and son. It's not really a perfectly logical chain to connect, you know, all of that, the malfeasance financially to why he would be, you know, capable, morally capable of literally shooting his wife point blank and blowing off his son's head with a shotgun. I mean, these are monstrous crimes. So there is this inherent challenge the prosecution has in any murder case, which is to establish motive. And we always talk about motive. It's the most fun part of the mysteries we read or watch. But motive is not an element of murder. It's not technically one of the elements of the crime. You could prove a motiveless murder, and the person could be convicted of first-degree murder. But for jury purposes, no matter what we say about the law, jurors want to know why. And they have often equated premeditation to motive. And so it's one of these cases where I think the circumstances, most powerfully starting off with a false alibi, you know, that's something that is really powerful evidence for a jury to hear. The guy lied about whether he was at the scene of his wife and son's murder. That may be enough on its own to convict. But add in things like missing clothes, missing weapons. I think it's a strong but not unsurmountable case. And the motive is kind of the battleground. You could have, you know, a very strange kind of compromised verdict where they only convict of unpremeditated, of second-degree murders. But ultimately, Rick, you know, what this jury is doing, and we mentioned this last week, they're looking over the room at this guy every day for 7 or 8 hours a day for a period of weeks. And they have to decide in their heart of hearts and in their minds, is this guy monstrous enough to have done these murders? I mean, just again, recognizing how graphic and horrible the murders were and that these were his family members. So I don't think it's a slam dunk, but I also think it's the kind of case where the gravity of the crime is so serious that in a strange way, the burden of proof gets a little lower. The jury does not want to walk away from a murder case where they think they have the right guy. So I think we're at a position where it would be very hard for 12 people to unanimously agree to acquit this man, But there's still a possibility of either a hung jury or a compromise kind of lesser verdict like second-degree murder. Again, we'll have a better sense after the defense rolls their case in and when we see closing arguments. But it's a fight. I mean, it's one that's not a slam dunk in either direction, to be sure.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Follow him on Twitter, at Trusty Lawyer. As always, Jim, thank you so much. It is 6:55, Saturday morning update. We've got John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, KT McFarland, and Tony Schaefer coming up in that 7 o'clock hour.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9. WMAL-FM.